The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Can't you just see it? Evolutionists, atheists going to an evolutionary church, making swimming motions in front of a blob-like amoeba. That's what's behind the altar, you know, a big blob-like amoeba. You know, it's amazing. Chant with a capital C, that's what you have to call it. Nature with mother in front of it. Chaos became order, randomness grew to perfection, and accident became some kind of an intricate organism. All of it very easy to believe. The evolutionary anthropological answer as to how we came to be here with presumably a certain amount of intelligence. How we in this modern space age of ours, in the fantastic day in which we live of miniaturization, of specialization in all the scientific fields, our technocracy that threatens to bury us in our own pollution, and yet we believe all of this could have come to be the way it is today from simple origins like amino acids and soups of methane and ammonia, like a chance spark of life that may have been struck long ago in some primordial soup as lightning bolts were playing around the surface of a broad, heaving expanse of sea. In the beginning, science says, was the hydrogen atom. And theologians say, in the beginning, was God. And the question the layman has to answer is, well, who do you believe? Well, laymen are told by the evolutionists there's no need to bother your pointed little head. You're not qualified to decide one way or the other. I gave you that quote here a couple of times before, and I showed you that I was going to give you a lot of the proof of the anti-supernaturalistic bias that evolutionists do seem to have, where they insist they will not come to any metaphysical, is the polite word, explanation. That they will insist upon a natural explanation, some completely evolutionary explanation for the origins of man, and they will not take anything to the contrary. Now, all of this is very easy to believe. That is, that birds and crocodiles are the closest living relatives. I'm not saying that to be humorous. That's supposed to be a fact. I don't believe it, but that's supposed to be a fact, the way evolutionists teach it today. But this is about as easy to believe as an explosion in a print shop producing a whole set of encyclopedias, or maybe a spilled load of bricks, a five-room home, or maybe a plane crash produces a brand new aerodynamic design. If you can believe that, you can believe in evolution. Or that maybe a Manzil or a typewriter produced the articles of the Declaration of Independence of the United States. Evolution holds the long jump record, you've got to admit that. That's British for broad jump. Because evolution believes in fantastic leaps. That's leaping the unleapable or bridging the unbridgeable gap of the yawning chasms of question marks and difficulties in the missing intermediate species that are supposed to make up the evolutionary chain. Well, it's a dogma. It's a faith. It's a religion. It's an assertion of belief in something from nothing. It's an assertion which is called faith just as much as theologians say they accept the existence of God on faith. Now, it's funny, you know, because the Bible doesn't tell you to accept the existence of God on faith. The Bible, after all, is an eyewitness account. We don't even believe people who tell us what they saw with their own eyes, let alone what the Bible challenges us to prove. The Bible says in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, to prove all things, hold fast, that is, believe and hang on to, that which is good. The Bible says, prove me now herewith. Well, that's on a financial principle. It means test me, try me out, and see if I will do what I promise. That's what God says. And in the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul was talking about some of the philosophers upon whose theories at that time some of the most modern speculative hypotheses and philosophies, especially in the fields of psychology, are still to this day based. And he called them fools. Educated fools, to be sure. But fools, nevertheless, because he said that which is evident about a non-visible, an invisible God, is actually shown to them by looking at the things which are made, by seeing the physical, material creation and the way it acts. So in this series, I've been exposing seven proofs that God does exist. The first of those is simply the fact that there can be no orderly universe acting according to intricate, interdependent laws, a law-abiding, order-filled, amazing universe, unless there was a law-giver. We went into that quite thoroughly. Law requires a law-giver to any intelligent being, and there is no other answer. The second major proof is that life comes only from pre-existing life. That's a law. You can call it the law of biogenesis, if you will, but it's a law as we know it today. It's the way everything operates. It's the way the entire web of life operates in the sea, in the land. Take a look at some of the questions, some of the difficulties that confront evolutionists today. I know the idea of the chicken and the egg seems to bother people. They don't like to get into that because religionists have used it against evolutionists and atheists for as far back as you can remember. But what about the web of life in the sea? All of the plankton, the phytoplankton, meaning the plant-like plankton, and the zooplankton, meaning the animal plankton, which are really microscopic in nature that float or swim about in certain thermoclines in the sea, or maybe float on the surface. Now, as some of these little microorganisms die, immediately when a body dies in the ocean, it does the same thing as it does on land. It begins instantly to decompose, and that decomposition is aided by bacteria. It begins also to sink. Now, it may sink down to where a fish eats it, or it may sink down and gradually decompose. The bacteria work upon it. These bacteria, however, as they decompose, these microorganisms and living organisms produce mineral salts. And those mineral salts gradually rise back up to the surface of the ocean. And then the phytoplankton and the zooplankton eat and feed on these mineral salts. Without the bacteria, the phytoplankton couldn't live. Without the plankton being alive, the little fishes, such as the anchovies and so on, could not live. And without some of the more common food fish known to man, like red snapper and halibut and tuna, and especially the salmon and some of the migratory fish that the vast fisheries fleets are after, from the Soviet Union to Japan to the United States, without all these little bait fish, as they're called, these big food fish couldn't live. Now, which came first? The phytoplankton, the zooplankton, the microorganisms that make up the krill or the plankton areas where even giant whales feed upon them, did these come first? Or did the bacteria that break up their decomposing bodies come first? Here's a cycle, and every last bit of the cycle is dependent utterly upon every other last bit of the cycle. And without everything operating perfectly, none of it operates. It couldn't operate except that it all began to operate exactly as it does operate today at the same time. There is no other logical explanation. I'll get into that a lot more thoroughly later when we go into the story of migration. And about mammals and birds and some of the presuppositions of anti-supernaturalistic bias in evolution, which insists there has to be some other answer, and they will not accept the answer of a creator being. Well, you know, anthropological museums are kind of like the evolutionary answer, I think at least, to churches. To me, there's a great similarity, because on the one hand, evolution is a faith, chance with a capital C. It insists in dogma. It says it must accept it without any proof, and it's just a faith, a belief. Now let me prove that to you briefly by a few quotations. This from a very noted evolutionist whose name is George Gaylord Simpson in This View of Life, a book he wrote on page 200. In science, one should never accept a metaphysical explanation if a physical explanation is possible or indeed conceivable. So even if in your vaguest, weirdest conceptions, you can come up with a theory or a hypothesis that might say, well, you don't need to look to a divine source, that's what you ought to cling to, never admitting that maybe a creator could have done it. J. Arthur Thompson said, and I quote, evolution is accepted because no alternative explanation is credible, end of quote. Julian Huxley, in his book Dogma of Evolution, an interesting title, said, our faith in the idea of evolution depends on our reluctance to accept the antagonistic doctrine of special creation, end of quote. Now, you know, it's bad enough to have churches attacking one another. It seems like religionists get a tremendous thrill out of bickering among and between themselves. And of course, religion is a history of splinterings and splittings and fightings and arguings over everything imaginable, from how people ought to dress to the way they ought to talk, to a manner of speech, to beliefs in various doctrines of divinity, and from the Bible interpretation of this or that passage, to whether you ought to have musical instruments or not have musical instruments, the way women wear their hair and things such as this. It's an amazing record. When you look back into the history of mankind, you can trace so many of man's wars and of human suffering directly to the door of men's thirst, men's quest, sincere quest, no doubt, for answers to all these religious questions. But so many wars were called holy wars. And what's holy about a war? But a lot of wars were called this. Religion and the squabbling between and among them, the belief that one religion is absolutely the religion and is superior to all others and must force itself upon all of humankind. This is at the very doorstep of some of the guilt along the way path of man's history as to the origin of some of our wars. Well, it's bad enough, you know, for one church to fight another. But evolutionists actually squabble between and among themselves in the same fashion. There are just as many so-called acceptable alternatives for evolutionary hypotheses for the origin of man, the development of how life began, whether it's dirty ice or polka-dotted air bubbles or heat or the opposite of it, cold, whether it is dirty old algae or brown scum or green slime, you name it, there are about as many as there are people around to propose them.
The 36-story Saturn V rocket which hurled Apollo towards the moon was not a product of chance. The manned Apollo lunar landings took planning, design, thousands of highly skilled technicians, and millions of man-hours. The full story behind the successful moon landings staggers your imagination. But have you ever stopped to consider that we too are on a spaceship? Spaceship Earth, with its life support systems and fuel supplies? With these delicate mechanisms to sustain life, the Earth is far more intricate than any conceivable human scientific achievement. How could the marvelous world we live in possibly come to exist by blind chance? Find out how the total planning and design found on Spaceship Earth is one of the strongest proofs that a creator God exists. This information and more is given in the free booklet, Does God Exist? Every thinking person needs to examine the proofs given in Does God Exist? Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.
You ever visit a big city museum and go into the Hall of Man where you see all laid out there, the so-called chain of the way life developed? You ever notice the similarity? Both of them, that is churches and museums, are darkened places. Both of them are large institution-like buildings. Both of them are public places. Now in the church, when people go in, they have a kind of a mood or a suppressed attitude. They're going in there to listen to the sonorous tone of a minister who talks for a few minutes, 12, 20, depending upon how long he can hold the audience. And I noticed a few articles some years back where, especially on good golfing days, they were having to cut them down to 12 minutes to keep everybody in there. But in these anthropological museums, you go into a place like, there are very large ones all over the big cities and smaller ones in smaller cities and so on. It's like a place of worship. It's like an inner sanctum of a place where people go to study their own origins, where they're getting down to the causal factors of things. And here laid out for you is first nothing. There'll be a white plaque and nothing on it. It might say words at the bottom. The first life was so tiny, of course, it could leave no tracks. And it's tough, you know, to follow a track of a microbe in a rock. Now, they try to deal with fossils, but microbes don't leave fossils and they don't make tracks. So they have from invisible to microscopic life forms. Very well displayed, interestingly laid out. Then the one-celled animals, the amoeba and so on, plants, plankton, fish, amphibians, birds, whales, finally the hominids and branches of those, and man himself, Neanderthal. Well, if you give the guy a shave and a necktie and put him in some kind of a suit, you could probably find him walking around practically anywhere, in a lot of cities I could mention, driving a cab in Rome maybe or somewhere. A lot of people take what is in the textbooks when they're in high school or college, much of which is pure speculation, as I showed you in a few quotations. It was so choice in past programs. I want to repeat one of these in just a moment. And they assume, here is this continual, insistent teaching that evolution did occur, and this is being done to kids whose parents probably go to church and drag them off every Sunday to Sunday school. Well, you know, it's no wonder that a little later on the kids begin to drop out and lose interest, because everybody, sooner or later in the back of his mind, begins to see that there's a conflict here. How could the caveman notion be true on the one hand? How can all these articles you read in newspapers about man inhabiting the planet 600,000 years ago, a new discovery of some tool that was probably a hand axe that somebody was grunting and scraping flesh off an elk hide back in North America a million years ago, and the idea that the preacher apparently is telling you about in church, that everything began about not quite 6,000 years ago. Now, how are you going to reconcile the two? Well, most people don't bother to try. They seem to assume that evolutionists must be the most intelligent. They must know what they're talking about. They make softer noises, and they certainly are far more respected people in all branches of society than most, not all, but most theologians are. Now, that's just a way of things. Why it is rather unclear, but it is just the way that things are. Science is looked up to with a kind of an awe which really should be accorded God. And when science speaks, a la the science writer in a newspaper, and any scientist who is a bona fide, a genuine scientist in some specialized field, whether it's anthropology or something else, will tell you that, and I'm not attacking the press, will tell you that newspapers, science writers, tend to overly dramatize some simple statement that a scientist may make. Life discovered in a test tube and so on, where somebody may have cooked up one of the amino acids and put together one of the little elements of many, many that have to be fit together in an intricate mechanism before you have anything that even remotely gets close to life, and yet the headline leads a lot of Mrs. USA and Mrs. Housewife Canada to believe that science has really, after all, done it. And there are many people that are under the impression that science has virtually, if not actually, created life. And they have done nothing of the sort. Well, you go into this darkened hall where you see the whole story of man laid out, and how like it is to a church. The kind of an inner sanctum of stained glass and candles and choir boys and pews and prayer books and Bibles and a minister with a kind of a droning tone with gargoyles and steeples and a funny kind of architecture with old saints and things around, altars and the like, the clanging of bells and the drone of words. These to me are the two antitypes. The voice of evolution that has pervaded every class all the way to mathematics and school and church and religion, on the other hand, that is such a part of the daily social life of so many millions of Americans. There are two antitypes. And each one says you can't prove anything conclusively, and I'm here to disagree with all of them. Because the Bible says you can, and the Bible says you must. Evolution asks you to believe in more miracles than believers in the Bible ask you to believe in. But why? If people do believe in the Bible, don't they at least take for granted that some of these people were as sincere as I'm willing to take for granted evolutionists are? If a man tells me he's an atheist and he's not yet been hanging upside down in a well and he's not yet been 8 days on a life raft in the Pacific, I'm willing to believe that he, so long as he is well fed and comfortable and sits in his own study with his pipe and his familiar books around him, is an atheist. I don't believe there is any such thing as a real atheist down deep inside in tragic and traumatic circumstances. I think people will reach down there a little deeper than they do when it's theorizing time, and they'll find out, after all, maybe there is some real desire inside of them to believe that they came from something a little more intelligent than they are, rather than green soup or algae. And when man is really in trouble, that's when he begins to call out to God, however awkwardly and in whatever words that may come to his mind at the time. So I'm not quite so sure there is anything such as a genuine atheist, although there are lots of evolutionists around. But the Bible doesn't say that you must accept it with no proof. Theology does. I'll show you. Theology says you cannot prove God. This was from a weekly column in a newspaper that is a religious column. And why don't you prove God to us in your sermons, wrote a lady to this one columnist. I would feel so much more secure if you could prove God to me. And I would feel easier day by day. So many things would be cleared up in this confusing world, she said. Prove God, he wrote. Well, I would have too much sense to try such a thing. What kind of a mortal would make such an effort? What kind of a mortal am I? I don't know, but I've made such an effort time and time again, and I believe it absolutely proved. I've done it on this radio program as well as in the articles in the book that you can have in print. What kind of a mortal would make such an effort? How would he begin? Well, I believe the way to begin is to discover and to explain, if you can, how things came into existence without someone to bring them into existence. How did first order, how did law, principle, how did energy, light, and heat, and motion all get started? Where did the universe come from? Where did the solar system originate? How did the earth get here? How did life start upon it? It's a logical place to begin. He said, I might say in the beginning that I believe in God because I cannot prove him. What kind of reasoning is that? I believe in something because I can't prove it. I believe I'm going to get 17 miles per gallon. Somebody told me that on a vehicle I bought. You know what I got? 8. I don't like to believe things because I can't prove them. He said, nor can I prove a million other things that he does every day, every hour, yes, every moment. Even the Holy Bible, supreme volume of religion and life, never tries to prove that God exists. Well, I can't answer for the fellow. He was sincere and he meant what he said and he certainly believed it, no doubt. Well, then why does the Bible say, yes, you can prove God exists? And why does the New Testament record, two words pronounced differently, spelled the same, a whole series of sermons on the part of Peter, especially, and the Apostle Paul most especially, and certainly John, that which we have looked upon, our hands have handled, and so on, which is an eyewitness account that God does exist, because a man with whom they had spent years of their lives, morning, noon, and night, had been taken out and put to death, and they had seen his dead body, they had stood off and watched him die. And he had been buried for 3 days and 3 nights, and they saw him alive and doubted it. And one of them even then had to put his hand inside of a wound to prove it to himself. And furthermore, it couldn't have been mass hallucination because none of them even wanted to believe it in the beginning. They refused to. Peter said, I'm going fishing, forget it all, it's all over. It was nice while it lasted, but he himself didn't want to believe it. So here's a biblical eyewitness account, and practically the thrust and the main point of every sermon in the New Testament is the resurrection of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And that you must believe in him who resurrected Jesus Christ from the grave. What is this? Is that proof or is it not proof? The Bible is a book of proofs, not only fulfilled prophecies, but the prophecies for the future, which are based upon those that were fulfilled in the past. Oh yes, there's plenty in the Bible that tells you to prove it. In a moment, I'll come back and show you that evolutionists also say you don't need any proof.
There's one question that has bothered man for centuries. Probably has bothered you also. Average men and great philosophers alike have struggled with this monumental problem, but it's a question that needs answering. The question is, does God exist? And if so, how can you prove it? The free booklet, Does God Exist?, offers tangible information that will help you answer this timeless question. You'll learn how matter, intelligence, and design prove the literal existence of a spiritual God. Everyone has an opinion, but how many have the facts? There's no greater question that means so much to your own daily life and peace of mind. Does God exist? Now you can know beyond any doubt. Write for your free copy of Does God Exist? Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.
Evolutionists say you don't need to prove anything either. The following was written by Patrick Moore as a result of his talk on BBC with a couple of doctors from the Mullard Radio Astronomy Observatory in Cambridge in England. And he said, the one vital fact is that the universe exists. The material in the galaxies, the stars, the earth, human beings, and even a kitchen sink must all have come from somewhere. All modern hypotheses start from either a moment of creation in the remote past, or else with a universe which already exists. Now, you know, your mind is a marvelous machine. You've got to have some method by which you can explain your own origins. Now, you just think back. Where'd you come from? Well, we all know the story. And like the kid who says, yeah, Dad, what is it you want to know? But you came from your parents and they from their parents. You can walk right back real quickly to great-great-great-great-grandfathers to the origin of the United States of America as a country. Not quite 200 years ago, you can go from there to Europe, you can go from there to the Middle East, and the footprints of humankind lead away from the Middle East. The so-called cradle of civilization, very quickly the leaps in the geography books and the books on anthropology and on history go from amoeba to Mesopotamia, just about that quickly. Very quickly, they get into the origins of the first so-called civilizations. Well, the Bible does the same thing. From creation, it takes you very quickly to the beginning of the building of cities in ancient Babylon and the so-called cradle of civilization, which was Babylonish, in the Mesopotamian Valley along the Tigris and Euphrates River. It's a fact. We know it's a fact. The footprints of mankind lead away from the Middle East. Well, that's what the Bible indicates. It's what anthropology indicates. And there are no solid, concrete answers to the contrary. Notwithstanding fossil men, which I will definitely talk about a little later on in this series, including carbon-14 dating, and show you how some of the mistakes have been made in calculation where it's highly speculative and not as accurately proved as a lot of people think. So he admits that all modern hypotheses, that is, for the origin of life, begin from either a moment of creation or where the universe had already existed. There has been no attempt to explain how the material came into being in the first place. And in this respect, the evolutionary theories, oscillating and otherwise, he said, are as inadequate as the steady state. What we are discussing, said this leader on BBC, is not the origin of the universe, but the development of the universe, which is a different thing. No doubt we shall gain much more information during the years to come, but at the moment, we have to confess that our ignorance of the actual creation is more or less complete. Now, that's quite a confession for a man to say, you know, we've got to confess that we are more or less in complete ignorance about the creation. Why do you need to be in ignorance when you've got a book that tells you exactly how it happened? And that book and true science are in perfect agreement. You look at the rocks under your feet, and most of them are sedimentary, and you say, how did they get there? Water deposited. You can see it. You can prove it. Geology tells you so. And the Bible agrees with geology that most of the rocks on the surface of this earth were water deposited. You know, someday, if a big glacier melts and Noah's Ark is really up there, isn't it going to shock the socks off a lot of people in a lot of classrooms and a lot of observatories who are writing a lot of books about amoeba and that God doesn't exist? Isn't that going to be a shocker if God ever does that and exposes Noah's Ark? Well, you know, why do they want to believe in Noah's Ark? They won't believe eyewitness accounts in the Bible itself, which actually tells you how to prove whether or not God exists. Life can only come from pre-existing life. That is a law. Law can only come by the means of a lawgiver. That's the first proof. And life from a life giver is the second proof. There is no other answer that would appeal to any logical mind. So be sure to tune in next time, and I'll get right into the third major proof that God does exist. In the meantime, write to this booklet, Does God Exist? Now, you've heard me announce it many, many times. Can you prove by looking at that which does exist, by looking at tangible laws, not guesswork now, I'm talking about scientifically proved and demonstrated laws which you can see, that you can touch, that you can understand with your own finite mind. Can you prove there is a God in the same way that science proves there is such a thing as an atom? Can you prove there is a God in the same way you can prove there is such a thing as electricity? Can you prove there is a God in the same way you can prove there is such a thing as air? You don't see air, you don't see electricity, you can't see atoms. You can only see what they do. We surely understand and know that atoms do exist. Well, there are seven proofs God exists. You write for this booklet if you want some real solid proofs for further research and discussion on your own part. All seven of them, one after another, very tangible, easy to read, simple to understand. And it's free of charge. There is no price. And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.